Well, today we're going to look at, start in chapter 3 and verse 6 of the Song of Solomon. And this section that goes through 5:1 is really forms the climax, if you will, of the book, and intentionally so, I believe. And it takes them after their courtship period into a time where their love is actually consummated. And you know, the wedding night for most people, wedding day and night, is the most important day of a person's life, other than the time that we come to know Jesus Christ as our Savior. But think of all the trappings and festivities and pomp circumstance that goes with a wedding ceremony. The bride anticipates it. I found out that girls start planning their weddings when they're about 10 years old. That's what my girls told me. They start keeping scrapbooks and looking at magazines and cutting things out, and this is what I want, this is what I want. And so it's really a time of anticipation as things just continue to be anticipated in. And then, of course, much money is spent on weddings. You know, we live behind this big white mansion. They had a wedding there last night. Those weddings start there at about $20,000. They start at about $20,000. You could probably drop $50,000 up there. If you know, sometimes the helicopter will come in and pick up the bride and groom, and sometimes there's a white horse and a carriage that drives them around. Sometimes they have live bands. We watch all this from our backyard. It's kind of cheap entertainment. But the extravagance that accompanies that very special day—it's a climactic day in the life of a couple. And of course, it leads to the wedding night, which is intended to be a climactic night. In every sense of the word, and yet everybody's so tired from the wedding, there's not much to be left. Actually, you know, I read a statistic that it was a surprising number, like 22% of couples do not physically consummate their marriage on their wedding night. They're just, for whatever reason, I didn't say the reasons, but it just said they don't. Maybe the excitement is gone because they have already enjoyed that part of the relationship, or it could be that they're just tired. Could be too drunk. I don't know where the survey was done. Seriously, right? I don't know where the survey was done. But anyway, today we're going to talk about consummating love. We've seen how the Song of Solomon has moved from an attraction period where man and woman are attracted to each other and praise each other, more in the setting of a vineyard and the fields, where he is more presented as a shepherd in a playful sense, and they're complimenting one another and expressing their thoughts and feelings towards one another, as we've been discussing. But then we move into a period of the wedding, and where the love expressions move into the actual sexual expressions and the consummation and the actual cleaving together, as the scripture tells us, leave and cleave, and they become physically one in this section. Oh, there's my honeycomb for the day. Y'all like honeycomb? Ever had anything sweeter? Well, then I'm just building your anticipation of it, because that's what happens in the passage tonight. I don't want it to be a surprise. I want something that you look forward to at the end of the class. All right? So we're moving from falling in love and then growing in love and expressing a certain deep feelings that they had to actually consummating love in their relationship. It's helpful to know a little bit about Hebrew weddings. And how they were conducted. There's a general pattern that we see in the Old Testament, New Testament times. We know that there were special clothes prepared for bride and groom, just like today, of course. And the bride would be veiled, and she would be veiled until the wedding night. And he was, of course, decked out with great splendor. And the wedding party also were dressed up. In fact, if they didn't have their own clothes, sometimes the host would provide the wedding garments, as we read in the parables of Matthew. And usually the bridegroom would travel from his home or his father's home to get the bride in a special procession with his bride's, with the groomsmen, to get the bride in a special procession, pick her up from her father's home, and then take her to the wedding place, which could be his new home or the father's house, wherever the right venue was found for a wedding, which had to be the right place because there was a lot of people invited. You'll read in in the song here about Solomon coming on a couch and palanquin, they're sometimes called. This is one from India. I couldn't, of course, find any photographs from ancient Israel. But this one is from India, but it gives you an idea of what a palanquin would look like carried by people and decked with gold, and there's a couch inside of it. And then the wedding itself would take place under a canopy, and even as Jewish weddings are today. And it was a civil ceremony, meaning that it wasn't performed by a rabbi or a minister or clergy or priest. It was performed more in a civil sense. It was seen as a social contract. And when you think about it, that's what marriage is. It was an institution given to man, a contract given to man before Christianity, before Judaism, from the Garden of Eden. And we recognize marriage as a social contract in the presence of witnesses, a public contract, whether it's in China as a Buddhist or in India as a Hindu or America in a church. We've Christianized marriages and have them in a church. There's nothing wrong with that, but we need to understand that they don't have to be that way. We can be just as married, going to a justice of peace and declaring in public that we want to be husband and wife. And so we recognize marriages all around the world. And it seems that the ancient Hebrews, the same thing. It was more recognized as a civil and public commitment that you made with another person more than it was any kind of religious commitment, although, of course, it had religious significance, and there are many exhortations about the importance of marriage in the scriptures. So they were married under a canopy, which, of course, would be decorated. This is a modern-day canopy, and probably in a temple picture, but here's an artist's rendition of what might have looked like a simple wedding would look like in the Hebrew culture. And, of course, many guests were invited at the time, and there was a great celebration called the wedding feast, which would last 7 days or sometimes even longer, depending on the wealth of the father. And then the wedding was consummated. And usually there was either their house that they were going to be staying in or a tent would be set up where, while the feasting was going on, the young couple would actually go behind closed doors or curtains and consummate their wedding, their physical relationship with one another. And then proof of that consummation would be when the linens were brought out that would be soiled, would be proof of the consummation and her virginity at the same time. Is it the Fiddler on the Roof that actually does that? They're having a feast and they go behind the first daughter, gets married traditionally. And there's one movie I saw where they come out and they hold up the cloth and everybody celebrates because the wedding, the marriage has been consummated physically. And there's the proof. So that was part of being a public witness to it. The friends played an important kind of role there, plus the fact that they're just celebrating. So the weddings are usually put off until after the hard work of the fields were done and the crops were in, and that meant usually the fall of the year because it took so much time and money. So let's look at chapter 3 and verse 6 and kind of work our way through some of the language that's used here. And we start with her speaking. And again, there's sometimes a question about who's speaking. Usually it's obvious, but there are sometimes questions, and this seems obvious that she is speaking. Who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke? Here he is arriving to get his bride. Pillars of smoke probably refers to incense going up from the procession that is led by the groomsmen, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense and with all the merchants' fragrant powders. So he's really done it up when it comes to the sensory part of this. He's got the incense going, and he's very fragrant. It's a very fragrant procession. Again, I repeat something that I've said. I'm sorry, would you please? Yeah. I repeat something that I've said, that lovemaking in ancient days was very appealing to all senses, and the ancient poets used to stress all the senses in lovemaking. Today, it doesn't seem to go beyond maybe the visual, even in its portrayal in the popular media and art and entertainment. But the Hebrews talked about what they saw and heard and smelled and felt and tasted, and we get all of that because the Song of Solomon doesn't want us just to hear about love, read about love. It wants us to actually feel it with the bride and the groom here, as in the book really should be experienced, got way down to the feeling level. So here you have the idea of a very fragrant perfume as they travel. In verse 7, it is Solomon's couch with 60 valiant men around it of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war, and every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night. Well, what we get is the idea is that this procession is royal. King Solomon is in it, and he's surrounded by 60 valiant men. These are the strong and mighty men of Israel, and the valiant of Israel, he says, and they all hold swords, being experts in war. They've proven themselves in battle, is the idea. And the idea of swords here certainly adds the thought of protection. In fact, it says because of the fear in the night. So I imagine that as the bride sees Solomon coming, you know, she's dealt with issues of insecurity back in verse 14. You know, when he says, come out of the clefts of the rock, you know, like a dove, come out of the clefts of the rock. In verse 15, chapter 2, verse 15, where she asks him to deal with the little foxes, the little problems that can spoil their marriage. Here she sees him coming with these mighty armed men, and certainly her feeling of security in him is vindicated. She has no hesitation. In fact, he addresses her fears again later on in chapter 4. Verse 9, of the wood of Lebanon. And Lebanon was known for its cedars. And if you've ever split a cedar or put one on the fire, you have that beautiful fragrant odor. Or the cedar balls you put, you know, the mothballs, pieces of wood you put in your closet. Just a wonderful odor. So another appeal to probably her homeland, which is what seems to be Lebanon. Plus the fact that we have this fragrant wood because of the oils in it. Of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin. He made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, purple being a royal color, its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. So here it was specially made by him. Now that seems to surprise her and impress her at the same time. His expression of love for her is lavish and extravagant. And it had the woman's touch, too, because the daughters of Jerusalem, it says interior is paved with love. Some translations say leather, which was a very luxurious way of upholstering something. But the daughters of Jerusalem had a hand in it to make sure that it had the right touch. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon. She says to the daughters of Zion, go forth and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. So she seems to be not only assured by his protection, and he feels and makes her feel safe, but she's also stirred by his extravagance. And she seems both surprised and impressed by it. She tells the daughters of Jerusalem, the young maidens, to, hey, look at this. And I think there's some interesting things going on here. For example, the lavishness of the palanquin just shows, reflects Solomon's great wealth, and it wasn't spared on this. He could have come on rough-hewn wood, or he could have walked, for that matter. He could have rode a mule, I guess. In India, the bride and groom get on a white horse, and as they have their marriage in a public ceremony, go down the streets. But the palanquin is just all decked out in extravagance, and he's wearing a crown that his mother gave him. Interesting reference to his mother, it seems, because you know marriage is a time where you leave your family and cleave to another, and perhaps the crown shows his mother's approval. It shows his royalty, and it's as if he is transferring his love and loyalty from his mother to his bride. Perhaps that is in there. But it talks about the wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart, in verse 11. So we have a great extravagance expressed here. And I think if we would learn something from this, there's one lesson here we see is that We have outlines floating around if you need one. Just raise your hand and they're somewhere. I think it shows that we're ready to marry when we feel secure. She had dealt with the issues of security. He had addressed it in chapter 2 and verse 14, inviting her to come out of the clefts of the rocks, you know, and be fully exposed to him emotionally and vulnerable to him. And then she responds by saying, well, let's work on the little problems that could spoil our relationship. And he agrees to that. And so there seems to be this great sense of security. And a great sense of security is what we need going into a marriage and to sustain a marriage. I mean, if there are warning signs before a marriage, you would advise someone not to marry if they're getting physically abused. They're physically abused before the marriage. They're going to be physically abused after the marriage. If they're emotionally abused before, they're going to be emotionally abused afterwards. Unfortunately, that doesn't prevent a lot of people from getting married who probably shouldn't and are not ready to get married. And I think the reason for that is sometimes people who are abused physically or emotionally, and then they find someone who does, as a child, they find someone who does that as a mate because that's how they've learned to respond and relate to people. And they, in a weird way, feel kind of comfortable in that kind of relationship. But that's not a healthy relationship. A person who's committing their life to another should feel safe and secure in doing that. Someone who would never harm them physically, emotionally, or in any other way. So it's a good question for people to ask before marriage is, do we feel secure with one another? Can I trust this person with my deepest self, my deepest thoughts, my deepest feelings, my goals, my dreams? Or am I afraid to talk to this person and relate to this person in total honesty and openness? Another interesting point I think we can get from this is that we should love extravagantly. You know, he appears, and I think she expected him to be quite beautiful and decked out, so to speak, but I think she's a little overwhelmed in her feeling. She said, man, 60 valiant men and gold and silver, and she just calls all the daughters of Jerusalem to come and look at him in the processional. When he didn't have to do that. But I think love, an expression of love is perhaps one time in life where extravagance can be excused, not as waste, but as something good. You know, what is the purpose of a diamond in a ring? You can get married without a diamond ring, but we want to show some extravagance in our love, an expression of our love. And so we buy things like jewelry, roses that wilt in 5 days, expensive dinners that really aren't worth the money. And there's no way you can logically justify paying $60 for fondue. She wanted to try it, so I thought, I tell you what, you got a handful of vegetables and a handful of bread crust, and they charge you $60 for that. Okay. But sometimes you just got to do those kinds of things. A vacation or a honeymoon where money is spent that people would say, oh, you're just wasting your money. There's a certain, this is where practicality can be tossed out the window. And I think that if a husband or wife are trying to be practical all the time, you're cheating yourselves out of a lot in a relationship. This is where feelings and emotion trumps logic and practicalness. Think of Jesus in the New Testament and the woman who anointed his hair with oil, and she was criticized, remember, by Judas, because this is a whole year's salary that she just dumped on his hair. Well, what was she showing to him? She was showing love. And we think of extravagant love. We think of what God did for us also on the cross when he gave the most expensive thing that he could have given for us in his son. So love almost demands extravagance. It doesn't just satisfy a need. Love goes beyond and smothers that need with beauty and all good things. That's what God has done for us. That's what grace is, when we get everything for nothing. And so in a marriage relationship, part of dating and part of courting and part of being married is keeping, I think, that extravagance there and spending a little money you can't afford or time you can't afford with the other person in your life. Well, so she rejoices to see her lover, and then he praises her beauty. Now it's his time to speak. And this section, beginning in chapter 1, and I would correct your outline because as I studied this, I saw probably a more compact unit from chapters 1 through 7, not verse 8. Because if you look at verse 1, he starts out by saying, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair." And then what does he say in verse 7? "You are fair, my love. There's no spot in you." So he starts and ends the section with, "You are fair, my love." That's called an inclusio in Bible study. In other words, bookends. And that kind of signals that that's a unit in my thinking. So I would change the outline 1 through 7. And he repeats this phrase, "You are fair, my love." And it's a very affectionate and popular term for her that he uses throughout the Song of Solomon. Now, he begins then a physical description of her. And you'll read about her dove's eyes and the flock of goats. Her hair is like a flock of goats. Her teeth is like a flock of shorn sheep. And he describes her mouth and then her neck and her breasts as well, as he praises her beauty. Now, of course, there's different ways that you could interpret this. You could take a wooden interpretation that she had animals running down her head. Of course, that's not going to work. That's not how we interpret poetry. Somebody drew up what it would look like if we took this literally. Can you see that? There's your goat's hair. This is Winnie the Pooh with honey coming out of her tongue. And, gee, what else you got? Her teeth are like... or shorn sheep, and there's the twin fawns there, and there's the shields hanging around the Tower of David. Not very appealing when you take it wooden, literal like that. Better, though, to take the poetic imagery. Now, the good, nice thing about poetry is poetry never tells you exactly what to think. Even though the poet may have something in mind, poetry is almost open-ended when you read it. And so you know that the author has something in mind. You're trying to figure it out. And you want to get to his meaning. But yet the imagery allows you, it stirs your imagination to think of other things. I think that's where we're left when we come to the poetry of the Song of Solomon. So you have these kind of figures of speech. If somebody's up there, I could use some lights off on the first row. Nobody's up there. Maybe Charlie, just turn this first row of lights off here. A flock of goats running down the mountain would, of course, represent her hair, and it has that flowing look to it. And I could use the second row of lights, though. The second row of lights would be nice. Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves, first of all. Verse 1, he says, "You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats." You have dove's eyes behind your veil. In the wedding ceremony, she would be veiled. And all he would be able to see is focus on is her eyes. There was a great emphasis on a woman's eyes in the Bible, but also in the ancient cultures, because mostly women were covered up. When we were in India and we're in the Muslim population much sometimes, the Muslims wear the burqas and all you see is their eyes. And that's all you have to focus on. And as we said last time, the dove's eyes are very beautiful. They're very plain. I was comparing that to some other bird's eyes I saw pictures of this week, and they didn't look at all as pretty. They're just black and innocent, very thin eyelids around them, and it represented purity and innocence, since that's what she had behind the veil. Her hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead, a very beautiful flowing sight. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep which come up from the washing, every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them. When the sheep were shorn, they were washed, and they would feel kind of frisky, and coming up out of the water, they'd feel a little bit exposed and vulnerable, maybe frolicking. It'd be with a different feel. So you get a little sense of maybe her playfulness or nervousness in the situation. Your lips are like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely. So her describing the lips as scarlet kind of implies that her mouth is closed. But of course, scarlet being a very beautiful color. The temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. Pomegranate, of course, has a very red center. And so he sees now then her temples representing, some say that the pomegranate represented had sexual references in that culture. Could be the color that he's referring to, or just the sweetness of the fruit, others have thought. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory in which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. This is recognized as the Tower of David in Jerusalem today, but probably some think it's not the tower that was being referred to by Solomon. I think it must have been built later. But the point is that a fortress had a tower, which is a place of, you know, lookout and represented security to the city. And then he talks about the 1,000 bucklers hanging. These are the shields all hanging around the tower, represented that it was either surrounded by soldiers and mighty men as a secure fortress, or some think that the soldiers would hang their shields on the tower to show their loyalty and their commitment to that city. And either way, it represents security. And the neck in the Bible is sometimes used for a person's character or a person's disposition, like a stiff neck is somebody that's stubborn. A bent neck is humility. And so it could be referring to also to her character or just her beautiful neck and being so well guarded, saying that, you have protected yourself. You have protected yourself. And he's impressed by that. She was a person of strength and not just beauty. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle which feed among the lily. Well, of course, he's talking about fawns, right? No? You don't buy that? Well, here he's talking. He starts at the top with her hair and her eyes, and he's working his way down visually, and for now he kind of stops there, but not a bad place to stop, I guess. He stops at her breast, describing them as fawns. It's obviously not just a reference to what her breasts would look like, but more to the pleasure that her breasts entice in him. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, if he wanted to describe their shape, he could have called them porcupines, you know? So he didn't call them. He wanted something. He's describing them in such a way that you want to reach out and caress them and pet them. I was at a house a few days ago, stayed at a home, and they had a little puppy that was about that big, and he's just a ball of fluff running around, and I couldn't help but just petting him all the time. And frankly, Solomon is seeing her breasts as something he wants to caress. And later he says all night long. But the reference to lilies might be her beautiful skin or just the innocence that they reflect. Interesting that she had referred to him as a gazelle, and now she's referring to her breasts as the fawns of a gazelle, again representing that beautiful, elegant animal. Okay, made it through that one. In verse 6, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, that would be morning, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Now, in context, he's just been talking about her breasts, and so commentators pretty much agree that he's just going on extending that metaphor and saying, I'm going to enjoy your breasts all night long. The two mountains he speaks of here, mountain of myrrh and hill of frankincense. Myrrh is very fragrant perfume that can be extracted from this plant, and frankincense, the gum and the tar, would be burned as an incense. And these are lumps of frankincense he's being burned here. So he says, I'm going to enjoy this beauty all night long, in essence, is what he's saying. And then he closes this section of describing her physical beauty in verse 7, saying, you are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. Now, previously, he had been saying to her, you are fair. But now it's interesting that he says, you are all fair, because he gets a deeper, more intimate look at her. And it's just
little observation that he uses the word all here. And he sees no spot or blemish in her, both in her perfection and beauty, but also in her character. And then he expresses the delight he has in her love in verses 8 through 11. He says, "Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountains of the leopards." What's he doing here? Is this a real, literal invitation to go away, like on a honeymoon trip back to her homeland? It could be. Some have taken it that way. Others, though, see that these mountains as the highest places in Jerusalem to the north, as the abode of wild animals, as he mentions, the lions and the leopards, as a place of danger and fear. And he's saying, hey, leave your fears behind. I'm going to take care of you from now on. And so it's an invitation to be secure in his presence forever. Of course, we know that everybody comes to a marriage with doubts, uncertainties, anxieties, even fears. And he's putting to rest and easing her feelings about those fears. And then in verse 9, he goes on, "You have ravished my heart." The NIV says, "You have stolen my heart." The word has the idea of you've swept me away. You've taken my heart. You've completely swept me off my feet, we might say. Some have translated this way, "You make my heart beat faster." Therefore implying that he's really getting aroused and excited at this point. "You've ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse." And then interesting reference to her as a sister, which was an acceptable way of referring to a wife back then, a very intimate way, an affectionate way of referring to a wife, because it saw her not only as a marriage partner, but as part of your family. And what a more intimate relationship can you get than part of your family? And I think there's New Testament validation of this when it says that in Christ we're all one. And so your wife, your husband, actually become your spiritual sister and brother. So not only are you related to your wife or husband as a spouse, but you're related to them as a spiritual equal, fellow heir of the grace of life, 1 Peter 3. "You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love, and the scent of your perfumes than all spices." So he's attributing extravagant language to her and in his excitement. Verse 11, "Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb." You'll see that honeycomb drips. Karen cut it up and it was dripping all over the place and kind of messy. "Honey and milk are under your tongue." Now, honey and milk is an interesting reference because in the Bible it represented God's blessing. Remember that Israel, the promised land, was the land of milk and honey. It represented sweetness and good things to eat, but just it represented God's blessings as well. And under your tongue, what's he doing under there anyway? Well, you see things are getting more intimate now. He's moved from the scarlet lips to, it seems, an open mouth situation where he talks about under your tongue. Now, we know that this is not a French kiss because there was no France at the time. But it will forever remain a bedroom kiss, or a biblical kiss, if you will. And I could preach a sermon here, but you know what? When I see two people going at it in public on TV, I think my personal feelings is, and on a biblical basis, that a French kiss is a bedroom kiss. And that's where it should be. And two people who are not married have no business being in each other's mouth. That's my thoughts on that. There are appropriate expressions of lovemaking at each stage. And that is a very intimate thing that two people can enjoy as they're married. "And the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon." He's noticing her garments and dress and the fact that she's all smelling very well. So he's taking great delight in her love. And then in verses 12 through 15, have an interesting section where I would title it, He Praises Her Virginity. And you see if you agree with me. Look at the language that is being used in praise of her virginity. In verse 12, he says, "A garden enclosed is my sister and spouse." Like today, you could enclose a garden. That would keep out the deer, keep out the critters from spoiling the garden. And it refers to the fact that she has protected herself and the valuable fruits and vegetables, produce in the garden. Then he refers to her as a spring shut up and a fountain sealed. And, of course, water also to be protected. A well to be protected would have a cover on it. And you could protect water from animals as well, put a fence around it today. The point is, all along, that she has protected herself. She has been sealed. She has been locked up. Then he, verse 13, refers to "Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, and with all the chief spices." He's piling on in his language all the good spices that he can think of, referring to her plants. Again, it's hard to avoid the idea that he is thinking about her virginity and her virgin parts, if you will. And some people even get more graphic in their interpretations as they look at how the plants are shaped and colored and things like that to describe her sexual area. I guess that's what poetry lets you do, if you're so inclined to do that, and I can't criticize that. But we all would agree here that he's thinking sexually. He's thinking of her most private area. She's been a virgin. She's been shut up. Verse 15, "A fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon." Interesting, the progression here is that a fountain of gardens, a fountain takes care of a garden. A well takes care of a city, but streams take care of a whole country. And so the idea is what was sealed up is going to open up and become available, I think, in that progression. Now, she responds to his praise. By the way, when he talks about her in reference to water that is flowing and streams that are flowing, Solomon does the same thing in Proverbs chapter 5, verses 17 through 19, which you can jot down and look at later. But he talks about, don't be with a strange woman. Why should your waters be dispersed in the street? And, be satisfied with her breasts. And he says, and enjoy, the wife, your own wife, and be satisfied with her. And there, as here, some people have taken that reference of waters being spilled in the streets and here waters being opened as the sexual fluids that are flowing. So just want you to be aware of that interpretation. And again, poetry certainly allows that. I mean, that's where we're going on the wedding night, right? And she is so aroused by the situation let's just pause here and say great lovemaking is a result of right attitudes and words. Because in verse 16, she is so aroused by the situation, she invites him to come in. But how did we get there? How did we get there? It took courtship. It took words. It took the right attitudes. It took assurances of security and working on problems. It took conversation. It took back and forth. You got to deal with the problems. You can't bring resentment and anger and bitterness or fear into a romantic relationship where there's not the right mood. They say that a man can be ready for sex in 7 seconds because men are visually oriented. But for women, it takes a long time. Somebody's compared a man to a microwave oven and a woman to a crock pot. There's a great difference in what it takes to be ready. And so a common complaint of women is that it's too fast and there's not enough preparation. Right. It's a whole package deal. Yeah, whole package, everything, not just words, not just flattering words, which can so easily get someone into bed these days.
It's not just the words, but it's an examination of a person's character and how you feel about the whole person. The security, the protection, the problem solving, the communication. You're right. Very good. So I guess what we would learn from the Song of Solomon is take it slow. Lovemaking is not just an isolated event, but it's the climax to a day. It begins in the morning with a good morning kiss or the right words or a phone call during the day that puts people in the right frame of mind and in the right moods. There's privacy, there's a focus, there's intentional conversation. TV might be off. We usually refer to sexual preparation as foreplay, but in that sense, foreplay really begins with, good morning, how are you? Or even before that. So there needs to be a reorientation, I think, that would improve lovemaking. And then she invites him. She's ready for him, verse 16. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. The reference to the wind, the gentle breezes, probably a reference to gentle caresses. And she's opening up her garden, her most intimate areas, that he might come in and enjoy them as a garden or as pleasant fruits. So an obvious reference is, but she got there. The point is, she got there through the preparation of everything before. She didn't just open up to a stranger or open up to cheap words or, doing her duty. I mean, she is ready, fully prepared because of how Solomon has been treating her. And then the curtain closes, as it should. We've seen enough. And the door closes for a time, and the friends are left outside, and we're left outside, and we're not going to actually see any more. The author's not going to offer us anything more. He's taken us as far as he wants to take us, which is pretty far, isn't it? But when the door is open the next morning, when the curtains are pulled back, we have a voice saying in verse 1, I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. So that's his report the next morning when we check in on him. And what he's saying is that I'm totally sated. I am totally satisfied. I couldn't be more satisfied. And he compares it to the nicest things he can think to eat, milk, wine, and honeycomb. You remember earlier in chapter 2, she had compared his words to the taste of an apple. And his love is, feed me with apples, refresh me with apples. And we had a piece of apple last week to kind of illustrate what that was like. Karen, you want to help me? But now he takes that metaphor of taste and beats her with not just the anticipation being like apples, but the actual fulfillment being sweeter than they ever would have thought with honey. Honey from the honeycomb. And of course, when you bite into honeycomb, the honey just explodes out of its chamber and has that rich taste. So I invite you to taste something sweet today and enjoy that honeycomb however you can get it out of there. You might have to lick your fingers later, I don't know. But there's nothing sweeter that God created. And in that sense, there's nothing sweeter than that God created for two people can enjoy together in that kind of environment. Now, we have one last refrain in our section today. And it goes like this. Eat, O friends, drink. Yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. Now, the question is, who is saying that? And we see that there's a celebration going on in recognition of this. And by the way, chapter 5 and verse 1, and this the climax of their sexual relationship and the approval of it expressed by this voice, comes at the very midpoint of the book.
And that's, I think, by intentional design. Comes at the very midpoint of the book so that the book builds up to this, this climactic day and night in this marriage with the approval that is expressed here. Now, who says this? Some think that it might be the bridegroom saying this to the friends who are out there, but they say, well, he's in the room, so they wouldn't be witnessing what's going on in the room, nor would, and the same reason, she might not be the one who says this. Maybe they're saying it together to their guests, but again, it seems to be a private moment, still in the bedroom. Some think that it's the songwriter who says this, and he's just making his own comment editorially, the poet. Some think that it's the friends who are addressing them, the couple, or even the bride, the daughters of Jerusalem are saying this to Solomon and his bride, that, hey, enjoy yourselves. And so I think the New King James says that it is the friends speaking here. The NIV has it, the friends speaking to the couple. I'm sorry, the New King James has it, the couple speaking to the friends. The NIV labels it, the friends speaking to the couple to enjoy themselves. More than one commentator has thought and tickled my own thinking with the idea that this might be God at the climax of the book, at the pinnacle of this book, saying to these people, eat, O friends, and drink. Yes, drink deeply. In that sense, it is the poet speaking. It is the songwriter speaking, but with a capital P, poet. It is God who designed marriage, who brought these people together, who's blessed it, who's gifted them with grace and the relationship, and gifted them with the pleasures of sex, saying, enjoy it as you should. So what we see is marital sex enjoyed just as it should be. We should feel good about enjoying marital sex. There's so much baggage that can be picked up in our world around us when it comes to sexual purity that can be dragged into marriage along with its feelings of insecurity, its feelings of guilt, in fear. But in the marriage relationship, where sex is seen as holy and pure and the marriage bed undefiled, marital sex could be enjoyed, and we should feel good about it, really good about it, because God has blessed us with a gift. And just real quickly, I started thinking about, you know, how does sex outside of marriage compare with sex in a marriage? Outside of marriage, we accumulate guilt, but inside of marriage is freedom. We don't have to feel guilty. And there's insecurity outside of marriage. You know, if I give myself to this person, am I committed, or what are they going to do? They're going to walk away and use me for a night. They're going to call the next day, you know, and all this stuff. But there's security in a marriage relationship. Nobody's going anywhere. You can open yourself up to someone and know that that person's there forever. Outside of marriage, sex is used as a selfish thing to get what I want and to please myself. But inside of marriage, it's a selfless thing that seeks the pleasure of the other person. Outside of marriage, the guilt brings shame. Inside of marriage, it brings celebration. I know it's not easy to talk about sex in public. Believe me, it's hard for me to talk about it as I have this morning. But yet it's celebrated. And celebrated by the text we have, by the fact it's given such prominence in the Bible, by the positioning of these, even these words here, and the fact that God might be saying them. Outside of marriage, you have to worry about all the other consequences of sexual relationships, like STDs. Like today, they say one out of four people college age suffer from STDs. It's a problem. Inside of marriage, there's no worries about that. It's a healthy relationship. And then the emotional incompleteness, because sex was a resort that was leaped to prematurely before emotions could be developed maturely, and conversation, getting to know one another, and exposure and counseling, or whatever it takes for two people to get to know one another. Sex is a shortcut to intimacy, but it really is not full intimacy. And it short circuits the whole process, I think, God intends for the marriage relationship. So we should feel good about marital sex. There is a time, there's a place. The fire of passion best burns in the fireplace of marriage. Let's close in prayer. Thank you, Lord, for an intimate glimpse into a pleasure you have intended. And we thank you for your unashamed and beautiful approach to it for our benefit. And we just pray that we might have kept our thinking in line with your thoughts today. And now, Father, I just pray that this might in some way help us enhance our own relationships with our mates or future relationships that we might have with a husband or wife. In Jesus' name, amen.